before. I'm Hank McKinney. I'm the president of the Navy Memorial. I had an opportunity to take over here last August, and this is a very, very special evening for me. It's the third Naval Heritage Award that we've made in the 10 years of the Navy Memorial. So it's a very special award, and one we've only made twice before. First to Senator Margaret Chase Smith, and then second to Bob Hope last year. Bob Hope gave a wonderful, about 10 minutes of, he kept us all laughing for about 10 minutes. So Ambassador Nitze, I'm sure that you're going to follow that and keep us all in stitches here after you receive your award. No? Sounds fine. But Ambassador Nitze, Secretary Dalton, Secretary Naples, Secretary Lehman, Admiral Buchenwald, Admiral Kelso, General Chapman, Admiral Long, Admiral McDonald, who's on our board of directors, Admiral Miller, also on our board of directors, Admiral Skip Bowman, good close friend who I've known over the years in the submarine force, and Admiral Santos, who is the Dean of Naval Attachés. He's the Naval Attaché from Brazil. And if you're not one of those dignitaries that I just mentioned, I apologize. I couldn't list them all. As I've said before, if you have an issue with that, please take it up with the lone sailor outside. He'll be happy to hear your complaints. I've done it many times. He's a good listener. It's a very special evening again, and I appreciate you all being here, and I will not waste my time up here with any other banalities. I'd like to introduce the chairman of the board of directors of the Navy Memorial and my good friend, Admiral Budson.
Well, I thought that Hank was going to say something really favorable about me so that I could get up here and act humble. But then I remembered what Gold of My Ear said to a rather mediocre cabinet member: don't be so humble, you're not that great. Paul and Lizzie Nitze, members of the Nitze family, and friends of the Nitzes. And I'd like to just make one other special acknowledgement to General Leonard Chapman, who was a magnificent partner in the Navy Marine Corps team when I was Navy Chief, and he was the tremendous commandant of the Marine Corps. Paul told me a year or so ago that he was writing a book that he thought he would entitle Rogues That I Have Known, Some of Whom I Liked. And I knew that Paul liked me, so I hastened to ask, am I going to be one of the rogues? He assured me that I was not. Again, I think he just didn't think I was all that great. But as a result of that exchange, I think I had some influence as a former aide, and he's now calling it jotting. And we hope that tonight's coverage will kind of be in that context, as we have a number of people report on their recollection of what Paul accomplished. Now, one of the big problems that Paul had to deal with was the problem of Admiral Rickover, a man who did many great things and didn't make any of them easy for people around him. And Paul was the Secretary of the Navy who had to make the decision as to whether or not Rick, at the end of his age tenure, would be permitted to stay on active duty or would be required to retire and then be recalled to duty as a retired naval officer, which is quite significant to us military. Take a long time to explain to you civilians why. And that was done, and it worked. And then every 2 years, Admiral Rickover got an extension. The best way to explain what it was like to deal with a great man like that who had his foibles is to report that on the day that Paul came down to be Secretary of the Navy and brought me with him from the Office of the Secretary of Defense, Fred Korth's office was still agog about the great meeting that had been held between Admiral Rickover and Admiral Smedberg. Fred Korth had gotten fed up with the fact that at least once a week he got a very argumentative paper in which Admiral Smedberg, the chief of naval personnel, disagreed with Admiral Rickover on the assignment of a specific naval officer. Smedy always interested in trying to do what was best for the career, and Rick always interested in building up the caliber of the nuclear Navy. And Admiral McDonald, the Navy chief, was much too puny to resolve an argument where Rick was involved, so he always bounced it right up to the Secretary of the Navy. And after about the 10th week, Fred Korth got disgusted, and he said, "Get those two three-star SOBs over here and clear out the room, and I'm going to have it out once and for all." So they were called over, and the exec, Duke Bain, posted his ear to the door and reported to us that Fred Korth, who could swear probably better than anyone in the United States with the exception of LBJ, proceeded to work these two three-star gentlemen over uniformly for about 15 minutes. Absolutely disgusting that you two three-star blankety-blanks can't get along, and I'm getting blankety-blank sorry of having to resolve these arguments. And he went up and down one, up and down the other, and said, "Now, both of you get the hell out of here, and I don't ever want to see you in here again on an argument." He walked out and closed the door, and Smedy turned to Rick and said, "I have never been spoken to by anybody in my life like that." And Rick turned to Smedy and said, "You deserved it." I'm going to mix up the speaking order tonight because the Marine Corps was commissioned before the Navy. And I'm going to therefore call on the Honorable Charles Baird, former Assistant Secretary of the Navy, former Undersecretary of the Navy, a tremendously successful corporate executive and chief executive officer, to talk about Paul with regard to the Marine Corps. Chuck Baird.
Thank you, Porter. I had to do my jogging to get here. Paul, Lisi, members of the Nitzer family, it's a great privilege to be here on this platform. Think about what you've done over the last 50 years, or at least our small piece of it. And we were lucky enough to get four or five members of the team that worked with you in between 1966 and 1969. I'm supposed to talk about your relationship with the Marine Corps. And I'm going to just say two things, because I think some other members will speak for longer than 4 minutes, and that's all I have. First, everything that you did with respect to the Marine Corps was to help it. You always said, "I like the Marine Corps, and I want to make them even better than they are, if that's possible." But I remember one story in particular, and that's after I recall that you had me do a lot of work with the McNamara systems analysis people and with Bob himself on Marine Corps aviation and on Marine Corps manpower in particular. But this is a story that I think you'll remember. Maybe some people around here are old enough to remember the issue. But at one point during the Vietnam War, MacV decided to group all the air assets together and to take away from the Marine Corps their close air support and to do more or less what they did in the Persian Gulf, where they would set up missions 72 hours in advance. Of course, the Marine Corps was out there on the front line in the DMZ. What they really needed was something in the next 10 minutes, not something 72 hours away. The commandant came to see you and told you he'd just heard from Lieutenant General in Vietnam who had gotten this message. And you went to see, not Bob McNamara, but I think you went to see Buzz Wheeler, who was then chairman of the Joint Chiefs. You explained the problem to him. He went on a trip he was leaving on shortly, I believe, went out to Vietnam, talked with the general in command, time and convinced them the Marine Corps ought to have its own air assets back, both for Coast Air Support. And sort of an incidental triumph with was that the Army finally got some air support itself from the Air Force, which it had never had in the larger manner. That was typical of Nixon. He didn't attack it head on. He went around in the back door, got Buzz Wheeler to take it on and make it happen. And Paul, you're a marvelous American. You're a great Secretary of the Navy, and I'm proud to have worked with you over 3 years. Thank you.
Paul has received a letter from Craig Whitney, who is the European diplomatic correspondent for the New York Times, which I'd like to read. Said, I'm delighted to be part of this conspiracy to honor you for your distinguished contribution to the Office of the Secretary of the Navy, where I was privileged to work for you in the mid-1960s. I write because I'm afraid the historians may overlook one very significant incident. Sometime in early 1967, you agreed to give a speech at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York City. And as I had helped some with the drafting of the speech, Worth Bagley and Bill Thompson, our founder here, decided to give the executive ensign, as I was at the time, approaching the opportunity of escorting the boss to New York. We got all dressed up, I in my best dress blue uniform, got into the limousine and headed for National Airport. As we were arriving with only 10 minutes or so to spare until the next Eastern shuttle, you said, let me see the speech before we get on the plane. I'd like to work on it some more. The speech, in my excitement, I had left back at the Pentagon. You were unfazed. Take the driver back to the office and pick it up. I'll hold the plane, you said. The driver and I raced back. I bounded up the ladder to the third deck. You see, I did learn some things as an ensign. And there was Worth Bagley, cigar clenched firmly between his teeth, and Bill Thompson with a mischievous glint in his eyes as they handed me the speech. Ensign, you've got this backwards, Worth said, grinning. The secretary doesn't hold the plane for you. You hold the plane for the secretary. As our next speaker, I'd like to call on the Honorable Charles Boucher to talk about Paul H. Nitze as a Secretary of the Navy who also looked out for the Navy. Those of you who are not aware, Chuck has just completed a distinguished 15 years as Controller General of the United States, where he made a remarkable record, and was prior thereto with Arthur Anderson for 25 years, in between which he served 4 years as Assistant Secretary of the Navy. Chuck Rosser.
Yeah. Thanks very much, Bud. One thing we have to keep in mind is, you know, I remember when I first came in to the Navy Secretariat, my Admiral Wendt was one of the admirals that came down and met with me and paid a courtesy call. And I, being a young, ambitious man, started asking a lot of questions about the Navy. And I always remember what Wally said. He said, you know, Mr. Secretary, when you become a member of the Navy Secretariat, he said, it's like being made a bishop in the Catholic Church. He says, you never again will suffer a poor meal. And you never again will hear the truth. So when Bud builds us, each of us up here, why, we know that Wally's in him. Well, I told Bud that I knew there were many others in the audience that could do this job better. But I went back to Paul's autobiography there and was very taken by a few of the things that he had put in there about his 4 years as Secretary of the Navy. He pointed out early on in the write-up that managing the Navy, which at that time had close to 1 million armed forces and 1 million civilians, and we don't know how many, but many, many thousands in the defense industry, was not like running a policy shop at the State Department or at the Office of Secretary of Defense. You had to build a great team, and you had to perfect your organization to really accomplish what you'd want to do, and that is build a great Navy. And I was the first member of the Secretariat, I think maybe right after Paul Ignatius came in, and Paul, of course, selected me after Paul went down to be Deputy Secretary of Defense. And I remember how impressed I was of just how great the Navy team was. The members of the Secretariat, the Admiralty, the staff, right down to the commanders and the captains who were working on all the big issues. And I really think that is really one of the great attributes of a leader here in Washington when you go for these big jobs in the Pentagon or in the cabinet. I've been fascinated over the years to watch the White House personnel office put together teams that hardly know each other, and I think that you have to build these teams. I think Paul did that. He made some changes in the Navy organization that even Franklin Roosevelt had talked about doing and never accomplished as Assistant Secretary, or at that time really the Undersecretary of the Navy, and then later as President. But Paul worked very hard at improving the organization of the Navy, the systems analysis effort that he brought to analyzing all the different weapons systems and everything like that. And I think you have to look at the payoff of all this effort, because when you think of the Navy that we've had for the last 20 or 30 years, it's basically the Navy that Paul Nitze and his team and some of the ones that have followed have put together. We all know that, all of us who have been part of the Navy know, that you don't create the Navy overnight. It's really the Navy that you have today, to a great extent, was created by the decisions that were made some years back. And during Paul's tenure, the nuclear carriers, starting with the Nimitz, there was an agreement to build three of them, which later on has moved really right forward to the current carriers that we have. We had the move from the attack submarines of the 637 class up to the 688. I remember Admiral Clary coming over to my office one day, so thrilled that he had got the 688 approved by Paul when he was Deputy Secretary of Defense, and he was saying what a great opportunity it was to deal on an issue like that with somebody that was so knowledgeable. We had the new classes of the surface ships. We had the R&D for the Tomahawk missiles, which has made such a difference now in naval warfare. We certainly, for Chappie and the Marines, we had new classes of the amphibious ships. And I think in the strategic area, one of the great decisions that Paul made was moving from the Polaris submarine and missile to the Poseidon and then on to the Triton later on. I think without question that the Navy went from, in the strategic area, from kind of being the poor cousins in Omaha to having actually the strongest and the most powerful leg of the triad. At least I wrote a GAO report on that. Nobody from the Navy called and said that I was wrong on that issue and that. But I think, Paul, that you've just made a tremendous contribution to our Navy, and I think the Navy that we've had for the last 20, 30 years is to a great extent one of the ones, the one that you helped create during your 4 years. And so it's a great pleasure to be here. I will tell one Rickover story, too, and that is that when I had been in office about 6 months, Admiral Escara, who some of you will remember, had been Rickover's controller. And then he got selected to be an admiral, and he got an assignment. And then he came to work for me as assistant controller of the Navy. And he said to me one day, I think the admiral would like to spend some time with you, describe what the nuclear Navy and the Navy should look like in the future. Could you put aside a couple hours? And I said, I'd be happy to. And so we started that meeting off, and Admiral Rickover went for about an hour on what the nuclear Navy should look like. And then he turned and said, oh, by the way, he said, I'm having some problems down at Newport News. I'd like Admiral Escara back. I'd like him to work for me on this cost study down at Newport News. Well, I was getting a sign from Admiral Escara over in the corner. No, 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 you know, don't agree to that, Mr. Secretary, see. And so anyway, we kind of debated for the next hour about whether Admiral Escara should continue to work for me or should go back. And finally, at the end of the meeting, well, he got up and he said to me, he said, well, he said, you haven't quite agreed with what I wanted, but he said, I would want to leave you with one thought, he said, that I hope you will give a lot of thought to. And that is, he said, you don't want to be one of these secretaries whose picture is out there in the wall after you leave that nobody can remember, he said. And, Paul, I want to assure you that your tenure in the Navy as Secretary was such a success that we all remember, and we're very privileged to be here today to honor you, and we wish you the very best. Thank you very much.
Chuck Bowser referred to the systems analysis work that Paul initiated. It was my sad lot to be dragged away from my baby flag command, a flotilla of destroyers and cruisers, after 11 months to come back and be the Navy's first director of systems analysis, with a directive to report to Secretary McNamara within 6 weeks on the cost and effectiveness of the F-111B, which, as you may remember, couldn't land or take off from an aircraft carrier. And never having had any systems analysis, I said, who's the house genius? And a man who has become my subsequent dear friend, Lieutenant Commander Charles DeBona, now President of American Petroleum Institute, was fingered as the right guy. But I said, you can't have him. He's working for the Undersecretary of the Navy. So I went to see my beloved boss, Paul Nitz, and said, you stuck me with this job, and I've got to have one man in the Navy. He said, okay, who is he? He said, the fellow working for the Undersecretary, Lieutenant Commander DeBona. Paul gulped and signed a note, and I got him. And 3 weeks later, we were to report to the Secretary on our first partial conclusions. And Paul Nitz came in, surrounded by all the rest of the people that worked with him. And I gave the briefing, and so there were some questions asked, and I gave answers. And when we got through, Lieutenant Commander Charlie DeBona raised his hand and said that the Admiral got a little screwed up on one point, and then he straightened it out and gave the right answer. And people seemed to be pleased with the briefing, and they left, and Paul thanked us. And then Charlie came up and said, how do you think we did? And I said, I think we did great, Charlie, but the next time I screw up, just get up and say an additional insight on that part. But you know, he's still just as blunt and direct and honest today. Our next speaker will be Richard Pearl, who came to fame working in the office of Scoop Jackson on two of his committees, the Government Operations Committee and the Government Affairs Committee, and who has had a very distinguished career as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs and as a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, and is one of the foremost voices with regard to sound thinking on national security. Richard Pearl will talk to us about Paul Nitz's contribution to foreign policy and national security. Richard.
Thank you, Bill. The technological age in which we live has given us a new vocabulary, which includes the term nanosecond. For those of you who don't know, a nanosecond is the length of time it takes to say yes to Bud Zumwalt when he phones to ask if you would be willing to say a few words at a dinner honoring Paul Nitz. But that's not the only definition. A nanosecond is also what you get when Bud says you have 4 minutes to talk about Paul's foreign policy and national security accomplishments. Of course, it can't be done. Or at least it can't be done in a way that begins to capture the enormous contribution Paul has made to the foreign and security policy of this country. Since he drew the line under a successful career in investment banking in 1941, he has been at or very near the center of every major foreign and defense policy decision affecting the security and well-being of the United States and the Western Alliance. And he has commanded that center from a vast variety of positions, some prestigious and even exalted, like Secretary of the Navy or Deputy Secretary of Defense, some of modest rank, almost obscure. He turned them all into platforms from which intelligence, diligence, courage, and wisdom could be effectively deployed in the nation's interest. It is one of many extraordinary things about Paul Nitz that as long as he could exert influence in support of policies in which he believed, he cared little about the titles and the perquisites that preoccupy so many in this town, where power and prestige so easily substitute for program and purpose. There's a misprint in Paul's entry in Who's Who. Paul is listed there as, quote, American advisor, close quote. Someone dropped the definite article. The entry should read, the American advisor, as befits a man who for more than half a century has given wise counsel on everything from the effects of strategic bombing in World War II to the relevant cost exchange ratios between offensive and defensive missile forces, to the best way to elicit concessions from Soviet negotiators at the arms control bargaining table. Harry Truman and Dean Acheson depended on Paul. So did Ronald Reagan and George Shultz. So did nearly everyone of importance in between. And to be sure, there was the occasional high official, John Foster Dulles comes to mind, for whom Paul had such disdain that no trusted relationship was possible, and that was unfortunate for John Foster Dulles. We are now well into a period of revisionist history with respect to the titanic struggle that preoccupied Paul Nitz's public life, the Cold War. To hear the Cold War story told by many intellectuals and writers on the left, it was won by liberals who restrained imperious American presidents and secretaries of defense and hawks like Paul. In fact, as more reflective histories will eventually show, the Cold War was won by men and women who understood, first, that it was a war worth fighting, and second, that it was a war whose moral and political dimension was as important as the military strength that sustained and protected the Western world. Paul Nitzer, the advisor, made the most important, sustained, consistent, and effective contribution to both. From NSC 68 in 1950, arguably the seminal policy paper of post-war American history, through the signing of the treaty eliminating intermediate-range missiles in 1987, Paul manned the front lines of the Cold War, bringing skill, reason, and purpose to America's leadership. For me, Paul Nitzer, the advisor, will always be Paul Nitzer, the teacher. It was my months working for Paul in 1969 that led me into a career in government. No one privileged to work for Paul, and there are several of us here tonight, could fail to be inspired by the rigor of a powerful mind wrestling with great issues, and an equally powerful conscience guiding our policy at fateful moments. To a young graduate student in 1969, Paul Nitzer was and remains a shining example of what a career in public service should be. Some of Paul's friends here tonight will doubtless recall the occasional differences on matters of policy that Paul and I argued and deliberated about. I know Paul well. They were issues of tactics mostly, sometimes questions of timing or emphasis. But with respect to what mattered, on fundamentals, I can say with both humility and pride, Paul Nitzer has been for me and countless others the indispensable compass that guided us to victory through half a century of Cold War. Thank you, Paul.
Richard referred to Dean Acheson, and Dean is with us tonight through the medium of his son, David Acheson, a distinguished attorney who had to be in Europe and could not be with us. But he said, my guess is that few of you have heard of Paul's role as editor of a Winston Churchill speech. This sacrilege was committed in London 45 years ago this very day, February 19, 1952. Paul and Dean Acheson were in London for the meeting of the four ministers, Adenauer, Acheson, Eden, and Schuman, about Germany's participation in common defense. But the Nitzer literary role arose in connection with the speech Churchill had to give in answer to a Labour Party criticism of the conduct of the Korean War. Acheson tells the story in Present at the Creation in the following way. Returning to Prince's Gate near midnight, I found the household asleep, all but the Admiral Crichton of Butler's, Epps, who had waited to hand me a bulky envelope from 10 Downing Street. The envelope contained a note from Mr. Churchill and a speech he proposed to deliver in Parliament. Unless he had word from me in the morning, objecting to anything in it. We were leaving London in the afternoon. A glance through the speech disclosed the reason for this midnight message. It was a reply to a labor motion critical of Mr. Churchill's support of the U.S. position in Korea. And an admirable speech in every way but one. To stress how seriously the situation might develop, Mr. Churchill had referred to a top-secret contingency order given to General Ridgway, of which the British chiefs had been informed because of the British brigade serving in Korea. Public reference to these orders would be impermissible. Wearily, I awoke Luke Battle. He telephoned my secretary and Paul Nitz of the planning staff, asking them to come to the residence at once. In due course, Barbara typed a letter to Mr. Churchill informing him that I could not consent to any... objectionable part of the speech. I could not consent to any reference to General Ridgway's orders. Only President Truman could do that, and I was convinced that he would not. Paul Nitze and I then struck through the objectionable part of the speech and interlined in red pencil a different but passably Churchillian passage depicting the serious times which lay ahead and the need for the fighting allies to stick together in meeting them. Shown at last into the cabinet room at number 10, I found Mr. Churchill in a carefully arranged and dramatic setting. Alone, huddled at the great green-covered table, he barely greeted me, muttering instead, "Naked among mine enemies, and the sword stricken from my hand." Having vetoed the heart of his speech, an exaggeration, had I an alternative to it? To suggest one, I said, would involve the great impertinence of editing a Churchill speech. He waved that aside, listened carefully, while I read Paul Nitz's substitute, and asked to have it read again. His whole mood changed to one of buoyancy. "I can win with that," he said, and took the speech and read it over to himself. On my way to the door, he asked in a sly sort of way where I had found the time to do so much after receiving his note. By adopting his practice, I answered, "Working at night and sleeping by day, as you." And so, Paul edited the great Winston Churchill, and his words are now enshrined in Hansard's reports. What a fun guy. The U.S. Navy has honored us tonight, and we're grateful to Secretary Dalton for permitting Admiral Skip Bowman to be with us. Skip has had a magnificent career as a submariner. I had a chance to work with him fairly closely when he was Chief of Naval Personnel, and I've come to admire him as one of the really great admirals of all ages for his brilliance and for his understanding of the personnel and their needs. He's gone on to the greater good of being the third successor to the great late Admiral Rickover as the Director of Naval Reactors, running the nuclear programs for the Navy. Skip will talk to us about how Paul Nitz's regime looks looking back.
Secretary, several of you are saying to yourselves, "I knew Admiral Rickover, and that's no Admiral Rickover," and I understand that. The last to say that was my wife, just as I got up. This morning, as we were having breakfast here in Washington, D.C., some 171 of our 352 Navy ships were sailing somewhere on some ocean, doing something important for our country. Five carriers and their battle groups, seven large deck amphibious ships and their amphibious ready groups, but all manned by great people, Marines and sailors. Of that 171, 101 were forward deployed overseas, 6 months away from home, away from family, or away from friends, but again, doing what we are asking them to do. Altogether, some 50,000 of the finest Americans you'd ever want to meet. Certainly in our hot spots that we know about in Bosnia, Adriatic, in the Persian Gulf, flying Southern Watch, flying Northern Watch, provide comfort. Over off Taiwan, and other places that we read about and know about, but also places that we don't read about and know about. 14 port visits going on with these fine young people, the real ambassadors of this country. seven major Allied exercises taking place as we work together with our friends, binding those things even closer that are important to this country. Every one of our unified sinks supported as requested, supported with what I would call a forward presence deterrence insurance policy. You all know that. You saw it on CNN. Every day you turn CNN on for the last couple of years. It's the George Washington Battle Group moving from the Adriatic, steaming through the Suez Canal down to the Persian Gulf. The Nimitz Battle Group moving from the Persian Gulf over to the Taiwan Straits. The old Enterprise, our oldest nuclear carrier, bouncing out of the Adriatic over to the coast of Israel when the Syrian dust-up occurred just this last summer, and then down through the Suez into the Persian Gulf and back up into the Adriatic before that proud lady came back home. We know that happens. Altogether, over 400,000 of these young men and women, active duty, and 100,000 reservists, standing tall, waiting for the call, and supporting this kind of everyday action. As Jay Johnson would say, just another day at the office for your United States Navy. But it hasn't always been that way. There have been times when our strategy, our maritime strategy, would not have underpinned this kind of action. There have been times when our major equipment, our major platforms, our carriers, our submarines, our surface ships, wouldn't have supported this kind of action. And most importantly, there have been times when our people would not have supported this kind of action. But that, frankly, was before Navy Secretary Paul Nitzna took charge. He pushed a concept called sea control, and with that, he also pushed the instruments to maintain that sea control and establish the sea control. He pushed new strategies, new deterrent strategies, strategies that ultimately would collapse the Soviet Union, that now underpin exactly what I was talking about. And at sea today, as already mentioned, we see those carriers and those submarines, all the way down to the radars and the sonars and the torpedoes that were at one time Secretary Nitzna's vision. But even more importantly, Secretary Nitzna took charge of our people's morale. He formed in those early days the very first retention boards. I think, Secretary Nitzna, you call them retention task force. And those retention task forces would look into every aspect of what was bothering our people. What could affect our morale? What could make things better? In fact, it trumpeted a whole new generation of programs that we now lump under what we would call quality of life programs, something that's become almost a bumper sticker now. I think for this old Chief of Naval Personnel that among the legacies, I would want to number one, the father of quality of life programs for our people and the father of caring for our people. Mr. Secretary, the active Navy salute you. Thank you, sir.
One of the very special projects of Paul Nitzna in connection with those personnel retention boards was to get enacted the process of selecting flag officers younger. And when I was selected at the age of 49 to be Chief of Naval Operations, I got a call from Paul. And you know, the good news is that my policy has been implemented. The bad news is I expected to get quality personnel. I think he was kidding. You've heard now of all the great professional side, this distinguished man, and now we'd like to call on the man who can talk to us about the personal side, a man who for many years was with Gershon and Sterling Law Firm in New York, and for another great number of years had been the principal in a series of private investment firms. the first born man-child of Paul Nitze, Peter Nitze.
Despite my position on this program, you should all understand that I am the ball boy, not the cleanup hitter. I can't resist just in beginning Richard Perle having defined a nanosecond in terms of a response to Bud's request. A definition appropriate for this naval gathering is a millihelion, that quantity of beauty required to launch one ship. Some years ago, I read a piece by Murray Kempton in which he suggested that those with an interest in understanding the unpredictable changes in the beginning to collapse Soviet Empire would do best not to concentrate on what was changing, but to concentrate on those things which were sufficiently central to the Russian character so that they would survive whatever changes came to pass. Mr. Kempton's suggestion was that Pushkin might be a better guide than intelligence reports to that understanding. People are less complicated than empires, perhaps, but they are still complicated. Anecdotal material and curriculum vitae, even for persons so distinguished as my father, are necessarily fading snapshots which keep changing. And perhaps with people, too, we should search for those elements of the persona which are sufficiently permanent so that they survive all of the vicissitudes of life. I am no Pushkin, but I have no embarrassment at taking the title of one of Pa's books, Tension Between Opposites, in seeking the permanent elements of his character. With respect to his antecedents, I, having served for the last 3 weeks on a criminal jury, am painfully aware that everything I say is hearsay and probably could be excluded. This tension between opposites appears there, too. His father, Herr Dr. Professor Nitze, combined a fierce intolerance for leaky thinking with a romantic and almost sentimental attachment to the courtly love and chivalry which were the central elements of his field of study. He combined fearsome scholarship with occasional bouts of complete incompetence at handling the tasks of daily life. My grandmother combined a total mastery of domestic and romantic politics with the smoking of black cigars and the climbing of serious mountains at an age when most people had speed sitting as their primary athletic activity. As a son, Pa was both dutiful and rebellious. I hear that he was not often guilty of leaky thinking, and that he was sent without serious protest in a velvet suit with a lace collar to a school in Chicago where such garb was not apt to be the source of admiration. On the other hand, he and his sister used to often tell the tale of his drawing blood from her behind with his teeth in a moment of rage. And I believe he still preserves among his medals a medal for the Order of the Winged Foot, a medal which I understand he designed himself to celebrate that small band who had seriously tested the disciplinary tolerances of the Hotchkiss School. As a husband, he was both, I cannot speak with respect to Leasy because I have not shared the house with Pond Leasy, but with respect to Pond, my mother, he was both the most autocratic and the most accommodating of husbands. The nation's business came first, and there was not much doubt about that. Ma was unable, through humor or drama, to deflect his insistence upon correcting the errant child or the incorrect argument. But on many important matters, she was in complete control, even such things as during the short period during the Eisenhower administration when he was no longer employed by Uncle Sam or his minions, and he had the desire to return to New York, he thought, but Ma said no, and he stayed. As a father, he was both the most demanding and the most...